It's the Rise and Shout Podcast, episode 167. I'm your host, Adam Mangum. I am joined by Greg Rebell, the voice of the Cougars on KSL. We talk about Jennifer Hampson and her spectacular career at BYU. We talk about the Hoops team and where they sit, especially the health of Tyler Hawes, and what that means for the upcoming games against Stanford and UMass. We then finish off previewing the Miami Beach Bowl. We talk about the quality of opponent in Memphis. We talk about Christian Stewart's exciting season. And then we finish off with a talk about Bronco Mendenhall and where he might sit in the minds of fans. This is the Rise and Shout Podcast. Check us out on iTunes. Check us out at LoyalCougars.com. And listen to us right now. Welcoming back to the Rise and Shot podcast, Greg Rebell, the voice of the Cougars on KSL. Greg, welcome back to the podcast.
Adam, thank you. I appreciate the invitation as always.
So lots going on in BYU sports. One of the stories that, of course, is happening is the women's volleyball team, which maybe most BYU fans aren't as aware of. Where do you think Jennifer Hampson and ranks among all the athletes BYU has had as far as her success in multiple sports and at the highest level?
Wow, you know, Sweet 16 in one sport and Final Four and maybe a championship game in the other sport. Tough to think of it of too many female athletes who rank higher. Of course, it is a team sport, and there have been some remarkably accomplished individuals at BYU. Female student athletes, but relative to a team sport and what she brings at a high level, kind of an All-American in both sports, she's right up there certainly, and she'll have a special place no matter how far this run goes for BYU volleyball.
Yeah, absolutely. Hers is a remarkable story. Also happening right now is the of course the basketball season is in full swing. The out-of-conference schedule about wrapping up, and then the conference schedule starting here soon. The big story, of course, is Tyler Hawes' injury. What do we know about when he might come back, what his status is, and do you think this could end up, with this type of injury, putting a drag on him and the team through a good portion of the season?
Well, you know, other than, you know, Maui, which was last month, it's tough to think of a more key three-game stretch for BYU to not be at full strength, having, you know, missed opportunities to beat ranked teams against San Diego State and Utah. Stanford and UMass, while not ranked or at least named programs, that can give you a bit of a shot in the arm, and they are home games, and so you'd hope to win those games. Not having Tyler Hawes for either or both would make it tough, certainly not impossible, but tougher for BYU to get those wins. Tomorrow, Thursday, will be an important day. Coach Rose told me, relative to assessing just where Ty Hawes is, Coach Rose is saying kind of Gonzaga at the latest would be his hope, but he's not ruling out either Stanford or UMass, and he knows Tyler Hawes certainly isn't ruling out either of those games. Doctors have cleared Tyler to be as aggressive with his rehab as possible. He's spending a lot of time with BYU's trainer in trying to get that swelling out, getting some range of motion, and so if there's any way for Ty to play on the weekend, you know he'll do it. But, physical limitations with these kinds of injuries are what they are. And, I don't know how much good, a really subpar relative to health Tyler Hawes would do for BYU on Saturday. I think Ty Hawes is probably as good a judge of his own body and capacities as anyone out there. He's very careful about the way he works the physical side of his preparation. And I'm sure he'll be prudent. And, you know, Stanford's not, again, not a world beater as we speak right now. They're playing a game with Loyola Marymount and trailing at halftime to LMU. I don't think it's a team that BYU can't beat without Hawes. And I'll say the same thing for UMass, obviously. It's just that you want to be as close to full strength as possible for this really key three-game stretch, Stanford, UMass, and Gonzaga, with the conference play getting underway just next weekend. Nate Austin's already gone. You're not going to have Jamal Aites, and in fact, Saturday was supposed to be Jamal Aites' first game for BYU, and of course, he won't play this season, it looks like now. So it's been a rough few months for BYU health-wise, and this is just the latest blow to the Cougars. And again, Dave Rose isn't ruling out anything on the weekend, but he's not also ruling Tyler Hawes in, knowing as severe as that sprain is.
Yeah, and I think the loss of Nate Austin, not as talked about, of course, as Tyler Hawes, but still a pretty key loss in the middle. The BYU roster is pretty thin among post players anyway.
Well, so, you know, Nate brought as much from a defensive and knowledge of the system standpoint as anything else. He was replaced on Saturday by Isaac Nielsen, who occupied the four position but now plays kind of a stretch four, and went out and hit four threes in his first, you know, game starting at that position.
Right.
So he's already showing, you know, the kind of element that he might be able to bring to BYU and how teams might have to, you know, now go about defending BYU at that spot. So, you know, for every door that closes, another opens, and maybe this one opens in a positive way for BYU and Isaac Nielsen. What it does do is give you kind of a more consistent rotation. You'll have Worthington and Kafusi at the five, and now Nielsen and probably Dalton Nixon at the four. And I think if they were to go with that, I think they could have some success, you know, in certainly in league play, if all those guys begin to fulfill their roles as hoped and expected.
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely some potential there. And obviously Gonzaga is playing quite well in the season, assuming Tyler Hawes is able to come back to full health, which of course is a fairly large assumption. It's looking like there's 1A, and that's Gonzaga, and maybe 2A is BYU, and then it's kind of the rest of the field after that. Is this really is it a disappointment in league play if BYU can't place second during the regular season, or do you think some of those other teams, St. Mary's included, are good enough where it's more of a dogfight than we might think?
Well, second place has to be the expectation for BYU. St. Mary's has already lost two home games to Boise State, which is kind of understandable. But you know, losing at home to Northern Arizona—that's the real eye opener, and that dropped St. Mary's below San Diego in the Pomeroy ratings. So really, it's Gonzaga and BYU. And again, with a healthy Tyler Hawes, there's no question it's Gonzaga and BYU 1-2 right now. If Ty is out for any period of time in league play, you know that brings other, you know, teams into the mix perhaps. But I still think St. Mary's losing twice already at McEwen Pavilion is a red flag. USF, which people think would be a top half team, has not played well. San Diego's been the surprise of sorts, and yet I think you know, San Diego's expectation would be more about being top half as opposed to being top two or three. So I really think there's been a bit of separation to this point, and it involves Gonzaga and BYU. But even then, the separation between two and one, I think, is as great as anything between two and three, four, five, because Gonzaga is that much better than everyone else right now.
Yeah, absolutely. They're a very, very good team. So let's move on to the bowl game. So obviously that's the other big story that's hanging out there among BYU sports fans. A matchup against Memphis, a team that probably most fans couldn't have told you their record or where they fell, but if you look at the computer rankings and some of the other things, they're actually a pretty decent program, maybe one of the better teams BYU has faced this season. What do you think, as you look out to that game, what might give BYU trouble with Memphis?
Well, they're certainly balanced relative to offense and defense. They're the most complete team BYU has seen in some time. I'll say they're the best team BYU's played since Boise State in late October. Cal had Pac-10 talent and a very prolific offensive group, and Jared Goff is the real deal. But defensively, I think Cal was porous enough to drop them below Memphis in terms of a total complete team package. But I want to see, you know, but I want to see the game played before I, you know, marry myself to that thought, because Memphis is a bit of a mirage in that. You know, they haven't played a really good team in a long time. And if you look at who the, you know, the co-champions were in the, or the tri-champions were in the American Athletic Conference, one of the teams that Memphis did not get to see was Central Florida, a team that BYU did play and of course lost to. Central Florida is one of the tri-champions in the American Athletic Conference. Memphis didn't play them. The other tri-champion was Cincinnati. Memphis did play them and drilled them 41-14. So let's use maybe Cincinnati as the game to hold up at, you know, to show that the Tigers are a real deal, and then realize that after they played Cincinnati, The rest of their season was a loss to Houston, who BYU beat, and then games against the bottom six teams in the American Athletic Conference.
Yeah.
And none of those six teams had a winning record. So again, since playing Cincinnati and beating them and playing very well and looking and doing so 41-14 back on October 4th, what has Memphis done? It has lost at home to Houston, a team BYU beat, and then played the bottom six teams in the American Athletic Conference, none of whom has a winning record. SMU, Tulsa, Temple, Tulane, USF, and UConn. So Memphis hasn't really had to do much in a long time. BYU will be the best team Memphis has seen since Cincinnati and Ole Miss in early October and late September, respectively. Conversely, you know, BYU could say this is the toughest team we're going to see since Boise State in late October. But again, I think that Cal game is still kind of, I want to see how this thing plays out on Monday, because as porous as the Cal Bears team was on defense, I think it really was a pretty good offense, and I want to see where Memphis compares to that Cal team, certainly. But Paxton Lynch is legit, can do it with his arm and his legs. He's a top 40 guy nationally in total offense, has accounted for a ton of points, running and throwing, and he's been impressive. But again, I think Memphis has been kind of skating by for a while, and I want to see how ready they are to take on a team like BYU. And you look at Tulsa, SMU, and UConn alone, you know, those five teams are 5-31, and those were all part of this last little stretch here for Memphis. And so it'll be a step up in competition, certainly, for this Tigers team.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's kind of, the computers like them all right and would say they're the best team we've played since Boise State, but
and pretty evenly matched too. I mean, if you look at where they compare to BYU, I think you say this will be a really competitive game. Should be a close game, and one in which no one has a real significant advantage over the other. That's at least how we view it now. We may feel differently after the game on Monday, but I think everyone looks at the game and says, yeah, these are two pretty comparable teams. You know, Memphis 9-3 and BYU 8-4. Each team had three common opponents, which is interesting for an independent taking on an American Athletic Conference team. But I think with BYU kind of having a de facto scheduling deal with that league, you know, it might not surprise too many folks that there are those common opponents. But they at least have three game films to look at, each team can, to say here's what they look like against that common opponent.
Yeah, absolutely. As we look at the BYU side of the ball, obviously this is not the offense that we thought we'd see at the beginning of the season due to Taysom Hill's injury. But Christian Stewart had quite a day against Cal, seemed as comfortable as he's been since taking over that starting job after Hill's injury. It's kind of for all the bad of losing Taysom Hill, there is kind of embedded in this a pretty cool story of Christian Stewart getting to play quarterback where he always wanted to play. Is this enough of a story that you think should be exciting to fans, or is it still just, well, yeah, but I'd still rather have Taysom Hill back there?
Well, I think what makes it more interesting is the fact that this is it. I mean, he will have been, you know, the comet that blazed through the last two-thirds of BYU's football sky this past year, and he's done. This is it. I mean, he's a senior, and this is how he's going out. And so it's a great story that doesn't need to be considered relative to Taysom Hill, because he's gone and Taysom's coming back, and Christian's finished. And he didn't just play the position; he excelled at the position. You know, once that Nevada game came along, even though BYU lost that game, it wasn't on Christian Stewart. He had four touchdowns, no picks in that game, and really just carried on that stretch all the way through to the end of the season. He had three interceptions in his first game. That was taking over for Taysom against Utah State, so not a start. But he came in for Taysom, had no touchdowns and three picks. Well, he's had three picks the rest of the way. That's over seven starts. That's remarkable. 22 touchdowns and three interceptions over seven starts in this in a throw-heavy BYU offense for a guy that wasn't expected to play. It's a remarkable story. You know, Tom Holmo sat in our booth, and I think it might have even been the Nevada game, when he was a pregame guest, and he said, "I love Christian Stewart, and I also hope that he didn't play this year. You know, I hoped he wouldn't have to see him this year." That was just a fact, because Taysom Hill was that important to the team. then the situation became what it was, and now you needed to rally around this guy, and he proved to everybody that he could really play. And this means everybody that didn't want to take a look at him coming out of Snow College, too. And there were a lot of teams that said, we don't want him. Every team said, we don't want him. It wasn't just BYU. And but now that they got him, and now that he got his chance, I mean, how do you find a better story in the last decade or so of BYU football of a kid that came from nowhere to star? And, you know, people aren't going to think about this season as a great season because of the four straight losses and the things that might have been possible at the beginning of the year and the loss of Taysom. So they're not going to have that same kind of fondness, I don't think, when they think about this year. But I will actually look back on this year with a great degree of fondness because of the Christian Stewart story. I think it's a remarkable one. And, again, he's played the position like he'd been in it for a while, not just being thrown into it in the middle of a season. So I've been so impressed with him, and he's gotten better as the season has gone along, and he's put up numbers that – Adam lead many to believe that, oh, this is old time BYU football. You
yes,
know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah, it's I know on Twitter a lot of fans appreciate how he's played quarterback. Obviously a very different style than Taysom Hill, but an athletic guy and can beat you with his feet, but mainly has been beating opponents with his arm. And I think we know pretty well what we'll see from the offense, at least schematically, and Matthews and Leslie featured often. The big question mark almost all season, quite frankly, and you pointed that out about the Nevada game, that certainly wasn't on him, was on the defensive side of the ball. After a couple of fantastic defensive seasons by the BYU Cougars, this year has been probably below mediocre. What do you attribute that to? Is it talent? Is it coaching? Is it both? Is it maybe just a little of bad luck with some of the injuries? How do you attribute this kind of deep fall in defense that, you know, we expected some with the loss of Kyle Van Noy and a couple of other seniors, but I don't think most of us predicted a defense that would have this many holes at this point in the season.
The Savannah State game kind of skews a few numbers because right. of how few points and yards BYU allowed that game. But you know, even that aside, I don't think things ended up being maybe as bad, certainly statistically, as others, maybe kind of tended to believe as the season went along. I think they were, you know, a top half team at least in the FBS and most major important categories in terms of, you know, yards allowed, points allowed, third down conversion allowed, those kinds of things. But it was more about, you know, the moments in which BYU was victimized. And you know, scoring 35 at home to Nevada, you expect to win. I'm not going to say you expected to win at Boise with 30 points because that game was over early. And that was, interestingly, a game in which, you know, Nick Howell didn't make the play calls. But I think there were just enough moments in the season that there were letdowns from the BYU defense at key moments and key positions. And a lot of these positions were being manned by guys that I think Bronco thought maybe could handle the heat but weren't quite ready to do so because of the experience needed and time needed to master some of those positions. Bronco, I think, as he's acknowledged, felt that the system was going to trump any inexperience. And I think he found that inexperience made the system not look as good in certain games with certain players. It's ironic that BYU would get things figured out pretty well in the second year of the Robert and I era, so much so that this is the first time in a long time that BYU hasn't had a clunker of an offensive game. I mean, when I say clunker, I mean 7, 10, 13 points. BYU scored 20 or more in every game this year.
Right.
That hasn't happened in decades. So, you know, it was a year where the offense got it figured out, and Bronco felt comfortable enough to turn the play calling over to someone who was new at it, I think believing in the system over everything else. And a lot of the everything else, came to the forefront in some very key moments this year. BYU wasn't really out of any game except Boise State. This still could have been a much better season than it turned out to be. The Utah State game, things did get away from BYU, but it was almost in a quick span of time when Taysom got hurt spanning halftime where things just kind of ran away. And that was kind of a shock to the system kind of game. So you could almost kind of throw that in there with Boise a little bit. But, you know, it wasn't that far away from being that 10-11 win season BYU hoped to have, if not more than that, 11, 12, 13, that BYU hoped to have at the start of the year. Certainly the defense gets a lot of the focus, but I don't know that it was one decision or one guy calling plays as much as it was kind of a multitude of factors.
Yeah, so, I mean, It got quieted down at the beginning of the season, but it is common among all fan bases, and certainly BYU is no exception, that when things go south, everyone's looking for a scapegoat. You mentioned Howell calling plays and not calling plays depending on a couple of the games there, but you know, there's been a lot of on Twitter and message boards about Bronco Mendenhall and whether he's. I think the term I saw somewhere was Steve Cleveland, where he's kind of maybe hit as high as he can go. I wanted to ask you a question we got on Twitter from Andre Hutchins. He says, "Why is Bronco so scrutinized by the fan base? I want to beat Utah as bad as any BYU fan, but I realize the unique situation at BYU." He says Bronco is the right guy for the job. Why do you think is Broncos getting hammered by fans a little bit this year? Just the inevitability of having four losses in a row, or do you think it's kind of with the fan base hit that breaking point where there's just a lot of people that would rather us move on from Bronco Mendenhall?
Well, I think first of all, I don't know that Broncos' level of scrutiny is any greater than any other, you know, big time head coach. I've been in enough media settings around Bronco to realize that it never gets confrontational. It never gets testy. It never gets feisty. He never, I mean, nobody's ever out, you know, to get Bronco from a media standpoint. I've been on almost every availability he's had for years, and you can certainly find, you know, more intrusive and demanding and confrontational press corps than you're going to find in Utah. I mean, that part of it should not be much of a consideration at all. And then you bring it to the fan side, and how do you gauge him being, you know, what's being hammered and by whom and in what forum? I mean, if we're talking about message boards, I mean, message boards thrive on, you know, negative threads and confrontational threads. And so how else do you judge, you know, a fan base hammering a coach? I don't know that we can say he's being hammered or not. I don't know what the standards would be to judge it. I think that attendance numbers fluctuated through the course of the season based on the fortunes of the team and the caliber of the opponent. I don't think there were any, you know, ultimatums or not ultimatums, but yeah, I mean, nothing was really stated by a particular game's attendance over anything else. Again, I just think this was just a season that featured a four-game losing streak that got people grumpy. But I Adam, I don't know how you would even start to judge, you know, what's hammering a coach. I mean, and where's the standard? Where are we going to see it? And I really just believe this is a situation where there's enough reality relative to the expectations of the BYU dynamic and what they get to do with the players they've got and who they get. And they shouldn't have had, you know, four losses in a row in the middle of the season, but it would have been nice to not lose your starting quarterback and have to start from scratch in the middle of the season too. And that was a big factor. Would have been nice not to, you know, would have been nice to have Nick Kurtz for a whole season. Would have been nice to have Jamal Williams for a whole season. Would have been nice not to lose Ilani Fua for three or four games or lose Jordan Johnson for the whole year. I mean, this whole season has to be seen through the prism of injury and what it did to this team. And again, I don't know that it was any tougher or not on Bronco from an outside standpoint. Only he could tell you that, I guess. I know that he felt that during that losing streak, it was a tough time, and wouldn't it be for any coach? You know, I mean, I think Tim Miles made the quote the other day. He's, of course, the Nebraska head basketball coach, and he was talking about, you know, pulling a game out, I think 55-54, some narrow win they had, and it followed two tough losses, one of them to Incarnate Word. So here he is off of two straight losses, I think, and one they probably shouldn't have ever had, and they get a narrow win the next game, and he says, "Well, all this means is I can go get groceries tomorrow." And not hide out at home, you know. So when losses are happening or you know, inexplicable losses are happening, it's tough for any coach. But you know, BYU bounced back well this year, won four games in a row. The Cal can make it five, and I think, you know, can go into the offseason with some positive. But I guess I'm just not ready to, you know, concede that things are at some kind of fever pitch relative to Bronco Mendenhall. So yeah.
No, absolutely. That's an excellent answer. Get you out on one last question, Greg. are we going to see in the future with this independent scheduling? 2015 is a monster schedule, at least from the names on there. But one of the things that has people maybe a little concerned with the future always is the bowl games. Do you think that's always going to be, you know, kind of an off and on with the bowl games, or do you think Tom Homo is going to be able to figure out a maybe more consistent way to handle that, or is this just how it's going to be because of BYU being an independent?
Well, he's got his Poinsettia Bowl deal done. He's got at least two more appearances in that thing, I think, coming up starting in 2016, right?
Yes.
I don't mind being in every year or every other year planning ahead of time. That's just a fact of life. And I think BYU's flexibility puts BYU in a pretty good spot. I don't think the Cougars are ever going to get left out of a postseason. And I think Tom is smart enough to make sure that the games they hooks up with have appeal for his fans. I have no concerns about the bowl situation. I mean, it's just, you know, it's kind of a postseason exhibition. You know, unless you're playing in the college football playoff or the New Year's Six, it's just another game you want to go out and win. And you just try and get it in as nice a venue, with as much of an attraction to your A, local fan base, or B, distant fan bases as possible. Hope for as good as an opponent as possible, and then go play. And I'm totally fine with what Tom's been doing and what he's done and what he has lined up, and even getting Miami to go, you know, ready to roll. It's an inaugural game. They could have gone any number of places for conferences or teams, and they liked BYU, and I think, you know, ESPN's always going to have a factor in the games they run and they own as well. BYU is never going to get left out of anyone's postseason, and I don't think that's a concern. I don't think it should be a concern for anybody.
Yeah, agreed. And obviously, Miami's not a bad place to go in December, as far as leaving Utah or other northern states. Well,
right, absolutely. And, you know, Memphis, of course, has the geographic advantage, and they'll be the home team in this game, and they'll draw a good number of fans because they haven't been to a bowl game in 6 years. We all remember what it was like when BYU had that little three-year gap back in the early 2000s. Didn't go in 2002, 3, or 4. Getting back to that bowl game in 2005 with Bronco in his first year was a big deal. And so, for, you know, that's Memphis right now. They haven't been in 6 years. So, you know, they're going to be excited for what they've got going. And while BYU may not draw a ton of fans from the Intermountain West, they should draw fans pretty well from the Southeast and the East Coast, as BYU always tends to do when they head that direction. So, you know, whether or not it's BYU's biggest crowd, you know, BYU fans will be heard from on Monday. I have no doubt about that. And again, it's a venue that's kind of cozy, you know, 30,000 and change, I think. So it's not like you're going to be in some cavernous, you know, building that you know, is echoing all night. I think BYU can do pretty well, and I think the bowl can do pretty well with getting some fans in there. I'm not, you know, of course, the biggest fan of baseball park venues, just because of the logistics of the field layout. It's kind of unnatural, and where they place the broadcasters never gives you a really good angle to call the game. But I think all things considered, it's a great place to go for a game, and they'll do it upright, make it look good, and I'm looking forward to Monday.
Absolutely. Well, thanks, Greg, for coming on the podcast. Enjoy your time in Miami. Get a tan if you tan. I don't know if you tan, but
I'm barely going to have time to see the sunshine. I'm going to be getting in Sunday night and leaving right as soon as I finish my post-game conversation with Bronco on Monday afternoon. I'll be in there probably around 24 hours, a little more than 24 hours, as I get in and get out to try and get back in time for the UMass basketball game on Tuesday at noon. So it'll be a late-night Stanford basketball game Saturday night. It's a 9 o'clock tip, so I'll get off the air around midnight, go home, get a couple hours sleep, get up, get to the airport, get on a plane to Miami, you know, do some game prep Sunday night, maybe find a place that serves a late night Cuban sandwich, and then get up early Monday, get to the park, call the game, get on a plane, get home, get some sleep, do a basketball game. So it's going to be a fun filled few days coming up this weekend.
Well, I hope you get a nap for Christmas then, Greg. That's what I'm hoping for you.
So that a nap and a bag of Ricola lozenges, and I'll be fine.
Well, we look forward to your coverage of the game. Of course, always check you out on Twitter at Greg Rebell and on KSL.com. Thanks for coming on, and we will have you on again soon.
So, thanks again. Always good to be with you, and happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and I'm sure we'll talk to you after the new year.
Thanks, Greg.
See you, Adam.
angelic hosts proclaim Christ is born in Bethlehem. Hark, the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn King.
Hark, the herald angels sing.
Sing.
Hark, the herald.
Hey.
Hark, the herald.
Yeah.
Celebrate the joy.